Welcome to Theatre Voice. I am actually at Sadler's Wells, although we're about to talk about a show that's currently at the Young Vic and then going to Manchester to home, and then it's going to Luxembourg.
That's right.
And what's the name of the theatre in Luxembourg?
It's Théâtre de la Ville, as Grand Théâtre it's called, so it's in the centre of Luxembourg City.
And the clue to all this is I'm actually with Walter Meyer-Johann, have I got that right? Who is actually, well, he's the artistic director of Home, that's right. Isn't it? Do you call yourself artistic director?
I call myself artistic director of theatre at home because we have two theatres, five cinemas and a gallery as well. So it's like a mini Barbican of the North.
Oh, that sounds absolutely wonderful. We're not actually here to talk about that.
That's
we are actually here to talk about The Emperor. I was about to call it a one-person show, or actually it's a two-hander, starring Catherine Hunter, but actually between them, Catherine Hunter and her, the musician, whom you're going to help me to pronounce the name of.
He's called Temesgen Zeleke. I hope I pronounced it really correctly.
Temesgen Zeleke is the musician who plays all the young people in the show and the music. And well, between them, they play so many people. We'll come to that in a moment. We're sort of here to talk about The Emperor, when the Emperor is Haile Selassie, and it's a play written by Colin Teevan. And we're here, in a way, I suppose, to talk about the way that you three collaborate, because there's been more than one collaboration between Catherine and Walter and Colin. But before I do that, let's just fill in the background, because you are... I don't know what you think of Brexit, but, you know, you are the most real European I've ever met. You better explain your background, because it's so many different countries. And now you're even more international because you're working out of Manchester, not London, and I find that particularly good.
Yeah, so I was actually born in Holland, in Amsterdam, to German and Austrian parents. Grew up in Holland, but had a three-year stint in America, actually, from 1 to 4. My father was working, so not in the arts at all, he was working for Polaroid. And my mother was an English teacher, so English was always basically part of the big deal. And then when I was 17, we actually moved to Germany because my father then switched companies, and I then did my A-levels in southern Germany. And that was also the year when the war came down. So my destination, of course, like so many other people, was to go to Berlin. And so I've lived and studied in Berlin for 10 years and then spent a year in the UK and have now actually been in the UK for 11 years. So it's quite a while, basically, now. I was an associate director at the Young Vic for three years, from 2007 till 10. I was very fortunate to have met David Lann because I think, as I mentioned before, I trained for 4 years in Berlin. And I would always say that was my German school, but actually when I started working in the UK and in the Young Vic, of all places, which I didn't know it, well, I knew it, I'd seen shows there, but I didn't know what a great building it was from the inside. That, in a way, was my UK school of thinking. And I was, of course, very fortunate to have met David, and also that his interest is on directors. I mean, he's a writer himself, so... He came from the Royal Court, so of course he created a different branding, which was more the director's led. But his commitment to international work was just really great for me, because through him I met other people and we got to get to know, like, we worked at Peter Brook's Bouffe du Nord with Kafka's Monkey, so it was fantastic for me as well.
Well, we probably should move on, but I just wanted to talk about the way working in Europe informs your work altogether and your work here. And just looking at the things you've done, what I love is I'm trying to imagine Eightborn in Germany. I'm trying to imagine Patrick Barlow's National Theatre of Brent's Messiah. And that was in Germany as well?
In Dresden, yeah, that's right.
And was that in English?
No, that was all in German. They were all in German. And, yeah, I mean, they were both not chosen by myself, but actually given to me. With Dresden, I had a really long relationship. I worked there almost for 7 years. And I was an artistic director of new writing there as well, within the big, big state theatre, which is extraordinary because it has a resident ensemble of 44 actors. It produces about 18 shows a year, so it's huge. But interestingly enough, Patrick Barlow, I hadn't heard of him before, but basically when they offered me, I loved it. I thought it was I had two really outstanding comedians from the ensemble in Dresden, and it was a hoot. I mean, it was fantastic. We loved it, and it ran actually for 2 years. I mean, not the whole year. They just promoted over Christmas. And yeah, the Eekhoorn was also commissioned basically to work in a theatre I hadn't worked before, but it was very interesting. But yeah, I think I've always been drawn to the Anglo world in a way, because I grew up in Holland, so English was always, it's like the part of the DNA almost there. And my mother, I mean, her English is very, very good. So, but I also done O'Neill, you know, I've done, and other, I've done Arthur Miller, I've done two Arthur Millers actually. So I've been drawn quite a lot, yeah, to the Anglo world, I would say.
Yes, well, certainly the world is your oyster if we're going to include North America as well, which we are here. and at the same time, you can do the Kleist and the Schiller and all those sorts of, you know, what we would expect to come out of continental Europe. But there's more, isn't there? There are different aesthetics that meet in you, aren't there? There's the aesthetic of Europe. Where now, is that more director-led in Europe, would you say?
I mean, I can't speak the whole of Europe, basically, where I trained in Berlin, and it was definitely, that was actually a directing course, so that was 4 years, and we were heavily trained at conceptual theatre, which always included set design as being an integral part, basically, and we had to write pages and pages about the concept, which actually, I, in a way, had to unlearn a bit, and that was actually quite a delight to then working in the UK, where this is not so heavy, where I always felt like I've been quite conceptually driven always, but then I thought actually working with UK actors who don't have that background but have a more psychological, it just, my dream is always actually to unite these two theatre forms and basically have a more, I would say, more aesthetical approach in the set design, and then actually with a, well, working with wonderful actors in this country, that's the marriage of the two would be my dream scenario.
What about working then with the actual writer and when they're alive, obviously? I mean, in this particular case, did you get to work with Colin, you and Catherine, or was it basically you?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually, because, I mean, we did this project before, Kafka's Monkey, at the Young Vic, and that was basically our first collaboration, but there, of course, the text was already set because it was all Kafka. And Colin did a beautiful job in sort of turning Kafka into verse, which was for me quite an extraordinary experience because I can read Kafka in the original, basically. And then this was basically, I would say, on the same page, but in a way a different beast, because it really meant that Colin has adapted basically Kapuscinski, the whole book. But it started very collaboratively. We had three workshops, 3 weeks basically, over spread over half a year. And we start, the first session was actually, we had copies of the book and literally took some scissors and cut the passages we liked and stuck them onto the wall. And that's basically what he took with him then. And basically then we had another session that he just first of all collected what we wanted basically. But it was still, that would have been a 6-hour show, that was still too long. Because the book is around 140 pages, and I think coming out of the first workshop, we still had about 60 or 70 pages, far too long. And we then gradually agreed on how many characters, so instead of 35, we said 11. So in the original book, it's 35 servants.
35 servants. Right. Do you think we should just very briefly explain the setup here? You explain it, that, you know, who we are meeting here, and whom we are meeting vicariously, Haile Selassie, I suppose.
That's right. Yeah. So Richard Kapuscinski, that's what he claims, in 1975, after the fall of Haile Selassie, basically returned, he'd been before, to Ethiopia to interview in secret the sort of the former servants of Haile Selassie. And by doing that, he claims to have basically written down what they've said, and then, well, almost like a collage, he creates a picture of Haile Selassie through the voices of the servants. In the book, they're 35, and I mean, Catherine's amazing anyway, but 35 would have been quite hard for the audience as well to differentiate. So what we agreed on was to say we're going to have 11, but the book is fascinating because all the servants talk about Haile Selassie, but he never appears in a way. So he's all talked about. And it's very interesting, I find, the principle of actually, can you translate that onto a stage? Because we always discussed, should we have an appearance of Haile Selassie? Should Catherine actually at some point transform? Because there's actually quite a big physical similarity. She could have easily done it, Or we discussed the musician, actually, at the end to appear in the chair as Haile Selassie. Mm. But then we thought, no, hold on. The book very clearly states it is basically about him, but not, there's never the physical presence. So we want to basically create the image of Haile Selassie within the imagination of the audience, and not a real... But it was very tempting. I mean, and Catherine, in many rehearsals, suddenly went into Haile Selassie just to try it out as well, the physicalization. It's a really interesting piece because it's not written as a play at all. It's definitely something between journalism and fiction in a way. It's something in between. And people have accused him, basically, Kapuscinski, about making a lot of things up and basically how could he have met these people if he did. And I'm sure he actually did, but it seems very easy when you read the book. It's all quite slick, but actually he would have put a lot of people at risk, basically, because after Haile Selassie, the next regime was terror, basically, and these people would have been under huge... they would have been in great danger, actually.
Actually, I think it was good that you did resist the temptation. I think the empty chair is much more eloquent, and even then we only get the empty chair, the empty throne at the end. And anyway, these people are all speaking in the past, and he's gone, so he's more present by his absence, I suppose, because he's fallen, hasn't he? I mean, we sort of know that, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, the book is structured in three chapters. So the first chapter is called The Throne, actually. And basically, it's all about Haile Selassie's, how he structured a day. And we stuck to that, and we called it the Golden Age. So at the beginning, basically, there are no signs of basically a downfall. But once the coup in 1960 happened, for the first time, his empire was basically under threat because there were so many people who were saying, you've got to reform, you've got to start reforming this country. And then basically the last chapter is his downfall, when he basically, one by one, all the dignitaries were taken out of his palace. And at the end, it's only two people remaining, himself and his very old valet de chambre, basically. Mm. And there were sort of only two left in his quite big palace. It's such an interesting piece because I think what Kapuscinski, the reason why he was obsessed with power structures, but also he felt this was a court which I think he learned from history that it was quite similar, let's say, to Versailles in the age we know about European courts where we talk about pillow bearers and nowadays we laugh about it. But actually our medieval system was quite set up exactly the same way. It was just unbelievable that this was happening in the 1960s and 1970s in a way. But it was the most important thing for us was always to say, like, Haile Selassie is a complex character. It's not like we're saying, oh, he was just a dictator and he killed so many people or so many people died through famine. He was actually also a big reformer. But I read in one biography where someone said, if only he had abdicated 4 years before they toppled him, he would have been seen as the greatest emperor in the history of Ethiopia. So basically he missed, like probably lots of great rulers, he missed basically the point to abdicate.
Because he's actually revered, isn't he? In Jamaica mostly?
Yes, it's mostly Rastafarians actually who see in him a god. And I only this morning again I read somewhere that he sent one of his bishops actually to Jamaica and said, can you please tell them that I was actually quite a naughty boy? I am not a god. Mm. But, I mean, this is what people believe in. So we never want to put on this play to insult people. I mean, we've heard that people are not happy about the book. We've heard that before. Mm. And there are people who are protesting very peacefully. And, of course, you know, it's like, I don't know, in every other religion, I mean, my parents and my mother is Catholic, so I wouldn't put on a play to insult her belief. On the other hand, I think it's our duty as well to, if there are other historical facts, and I think some of the facts are true, that while the famine was happening in Ethiopia, Haile Selassie did not do enough. And I think that's what we can put on a stage. We are allowed to do that. But yes, it does create debate, I would say.
Yeah. Well, Before we go on to sort of method, and I really want a lot of pictures of your working methods if I can get them, he thought how lonely he must have been. Because I looked it up, actually, and apparently he did have a wife and 7 children. I hate to think what happened to them. I was worrying about them. I hadn't had time to quite research that. You can probably tell me. But he surrounded by this sort of tissue that... I'm waving my hands in the air, so sure, there are circles within circles, and so forth. And as you say, like Catherine, a small figure, you know, you genuinely get that. I mean, that he's this tiny little figure with all this power. But yeah, the pet dog's about as good as it gets, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, obviously, there was wife and children, but we don't get that picture. I get this sort of isolation and almost being fossilized in some way.
Yeah, I think he actually had a very devoted wife, and he had many children. Unfortunately, when the coup happened, not much later, his wife passed away as well. So I think that really started to isolate him. And his children, he was a bit unlucky, I think, with them as well, because there was one of his sons, actually, was part of the coup against him. And he was very, very unhappy with him, basically. And I think he had a child who was also very sick and then was sent to Switzerland. So I don't think his private life was very happy, mainly in his last decade, I would say.
Well, let's look at him more closely through these 11, some of them are just valets, some of them are ministers, but they're all pretty devoted. They all have status, don't they? And I wanted to know how Catherine found them, because it's not as if there was a recording of them, so we've got no idea. You can only tell from what they say. And to watch her, and then we can talk about the transformations, but to watch her, the way you handle those transformations is incredible. But what was the work that, was that just the two? You're the movement director as well, obviously, but tell me about finding, I mean, it's all very well in Kafka's Monkey. She brilliantly finds the monkey and the ape, but this is 11 people.
Well, it really felt like working with an ensemble, to be honest, because she is then 11 characters, so you feel like you've got to actually nurture, like in a normal, if you had a production with 11 actors, you would always say, I've got to give everyone as much attention as I can. There are basically two main characters in here. One is LM, who's the older valet, and then there's ZSK, who is actually the Minister of Information, who I always call the Propaganda Minister, who's the highest ranks of them all, basically. All the others are more servants, basically. And the way we approached it was, I mean, the brilliance in Catherine is that, you know, even before we start rehearsing, so we agree on which characters we choose, and then we describe them, and then we say, okay, this is... the guy who just wipes basically the urine off the dignitary's feet. So we've got to add humor, we've got to find things, and it's amazing working with her because she's got such a vivid imagination. And how we approached it was we watched quite a lot of interviews with servants basically from who are a bit higher ranked, and we just looked at the way they talked, the accents, but mainly how they were behaving. And all of them, this is very similar to what we've been doing, also to the book, you see a big, big admiration and love for the emperor. And I think that's always the beauty working with Catherine, because the book is actually more sarcastic, I would say, more ironic. But Catherine always, the same exactly the same in Kafka's Monkey, that she was always looking for not the softer side, but actually the human side. And so by how do you talk about someone who's considered an autocrat by actually looking at how deeply these characters loved him. So you create a big contradiction between what's said, basically, and what we read about, and then actually how the so-called little people actually talk about him, and that creates a tension, I would say. And so we just agreed on, we need to make them as colorful and different, so if audience would have to understand that you go from the urine wiper,
whose job was to wipe the lap dog's urine off the shoes of dignitaries.
Right. There's one servant whose job it was. The emperor had a dog, a lap dog, called Lulu, who, when all the dignitaries were invited, they had to stand still, and basically this dog was peeing on their shoes. So it was his job, basically, to wipe the urine from their shoes, and then be unnoticed, basically. And yeah, it's a brilliant description, basically, when you just see a court and then you have a dog who just pees against the shoes. You know, it's brilliant. Yeah. To sort of suddenly a chauffeur, so you need to create different dynamics, basically, about how they speak, how quickly they speak, and how physically they basically act differently. And she, of course, is, we always call her Master of Transformation. So it's, I think I guided her, I would say, on these inventions of how actually to play them. She was really absorbed the information and basically played them very quickly in a way.
And then there are some little touches of costume that change, but she almost didn't need them in a way. A chauffeur's cap, some epaulettes, but it was much more the physicality. And she does change her voice as well. Yeah. And then some of them are really quick transfer, and some of them, as she goes from one side to the stage to the other, she morphs. And also you've got the music, which we'll talk about in a moment, and you've got the lighting and the most incredible soundscape as well. So we should probably just... your lighting is by Mike Gunning and Paul Arditi is a master of sound, obviously. It all works together.
That's right.
Doesn't it? I mean, I know it's supposed to, I'm just saying, and with the live music, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting that it was actually the same Kafka's Monkey. If you look at the creative team, it's a big, big creative team, but actually everyone is needed. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Paul Arditi. I mean, he's a genius in what he does. And we've had Dave Price helping Temesgen, but also composing other work, which he basically didn't do live. So they worked hand in hand. We had this set designer, Ty Green. We've had movement director, Imogen, video design. So all the people who worked here basically were all, interesting enough, serving basically the servants. It's very interesting how theater works in a way. We also have to all serve. I don't know exactly who we're serving, but... I think we're all serving Catherine in a way. And she was basically serving the emperor.
I love that she's called creative associate.
Yes.
I mean, that tells you something, doesn't it? I mean, what is she? Yes, you've got to call her something. She's not just an actor.
No, you're absolutely right. And also, I think that title also came mainly from acknowledging her work with the script, because we spent so much time on it, and she just found another passage. She is rigorous. I mean, she gets so deeply into material, and basically that's her biggest strength as an actor. But also, I mean, she directs herself, and I think she partly writes as well. So that's, you know what I mean? We all recognize, of course, Colin is the writer, but basically in this process, we all work together and write till the last moment. And there were even some passages where at the end, I said to Catherine, I'm sorry, but we've got to take this out now. And of course, that doesn't make her happy, but she acknowledges as well that, of course, at the end of the day, I'm sitting on the outside, so I've got to make a decision like that as well. Yeah.
The other fascinating thing, of course, is that all the characters are talking most of the time to one person, presumably to Kapuscinski, but except during this wonderful press conference where she keeps saying, she's being the Minister of Information. And, you know, he obviously knows all these journalists and he's trying to do positive spin. I mean, it's almost as good as watching one of the, you know, our spin programmes on the television, isn't it?
That's right. And also it reminded me, do you remember the Iraqi Minister of Information?
Yes.
Do you remember him?
Yes.
And that was basically, I mean, he was hilarious, and he was almost speaking in poetry, and he was a big reference point for me, basically, about how you can spin information, and if you're put under international pressure, basically.
Yeah. Well, whilst we're talking about him, he is one of the points that there's enormous amounts of light and shade and change of pace, and it's very funny a lot of the time. I mean, it's very tragic and sad a lot of the time as well. But this is her sort of virtuoso part, I think. It's all it is, isn't it? But this particular minister is incredible because he is constantly doing this spinning thing. He's the one that loses his son, though, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. But his son is a student and a dissident, and it doesn't go well for his son. So he's always got that sadness underneath him, but he's got this total loyalty, and he will spin the fact that international aid is being brilliantly used in order to reconstruct Whereas the press are saying, but you've got famine in the north of the country. Right. You've got Jonathan Dimbleby on your doorstep. There's also a film, we should credit the video maker, Louis Price.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because that's incredibly important at the end to see these real, awful queue of people.
That's right. I mean, it starts almost like a fairy tale. And when you read the whole book, it feels like this can't be true in a way. But we always knew actually everything that was done actually did exist. And then I always believe in theatre, once you play a film, you crash, basically. You crash your production because everything you've built up is more of a fictional world. That's what theatre is. Or you create a certain theatrical reality. Once you bring in real imagery, it just always, you just crash in a way, but in a good way, because I think here, the film, and basically famine, that was the big turning point in history for Haile Selassie, basically, because once this film was basically screened, journalists all around the world were just incredibly shocked, because before then, Haile Selassie was almost everyone's darling. He was invited, he was sort of paraded around the world. He had, he also enjoyed it because it was quite, pressure at home was quite strong, so he actually enjoyed being part of the international life. And then suddenly, through this documentary, it revealed the other side, basically. And I know we in the West, of course, we have a different view, because in the book it says as well, and that's what the propaganda minister says, famines have existed thousands of years. It's not new, basically. But what was probably new, that at the same time, Haile Selassie was celebrating big parties where caviar and champagne was flown in while his people were actually dying. And that, of course, for the so-called West was intolerable in a way.
So shall we talk about Temezgan Zeleke? Is that right?
Zeleke.
Temezgan Zeleke, who is a wonderful young musician. Mm. And I say young on purpose because you would expect to hear some of these other characters, maybe. But what's so clever is he only speaks through music, or presumably in, it's called Ethiopian.
Amharic,
the actual language.
Right.
But we know what he's saying, don't we, because of the context.
That's
and
right.
He's pretty well angry most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, we basically decided, because another side to the whole book and also to the play was always the young people who grew up in a system where they feel they're nothing's changing. And for all future generations, it always felt like the student's voice is so important to actually stage. And Catherine, at the beginning, before we decided even to have a second musician, she said, oh, I'm very happy to play a young student here, which I know she would have done brilliantly. But I always felt like actually giving music or having music in the play will actually help the emotional side to the story. Because it's all words, it's a piece about language in a way. But the emotional side, we get through Temezgan's beautiful music, and some of it is actually composed and really beautifully done. Some of it is actually existing music. But I thought what we really worked on strongly is to say, okay, and now we've got a voice of Ethiopia, but let's also have a voice of the young people who oppose the system. And as we all know from sort of from history, but also from current times we live in, basically, that this is what's at stake. It's not just Ethiopia now, for example. We know that there's unrest happening as we speak now. And there was an Ethiopian friend, actually, of Temezgan, who came in 2 weeks ago, saw a run and said, oh, my God, this is actually talking about now. This is exactly happening what's now. There's student unrest. People are being arrested, and it's exactly the same, actually. So it's not over.
What you're also doing here is it is incredibly contemporary, not just in Ethiopia, because I suppose, and I'm not really trying to compare Haile Selassie with Saddam Hussein and Colonel Gaddafi exactly, but these are still figures who surround themselves with these circles and outer circles and power structures and become these absolute rulers for good or ill. And the story goes on, and I presume the displacement of people that we're seeing now is bound up with it too. So it's a very old story and a very new story, and it will go on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talked about this piece a year and a half ago, actually, when, well, I mean, so much was happening in the Middle East. It's still happening. And at one point, we even thought, let's have Catherine, but let's have four other actors who come from different parts of the world where you've experienced a rule like this. And that was one idea. I mean, I'm very happy that we actually stuck just with Catherine, because I think the genius now that you actually see a court, but just you can't believe it's actually just one actor doing it. But it was the idea to say, okay, this is actually really happening in the world, and let's look at basically rule. I mean, autocratic or even hard dictatorship in a way. I think it's very subtle, basically. It's a parable, basically. I mean, Kapuscinski was talking about Poland at the time because he was the only foreign correspondent of Poland. So he was talking about how he believed his country was ruled in a sort of totalitarian way. So he was also talking about his home country. And in a way, I think nowadays we're talking about the emperor, we're talking about Haile Selassie, but actually we are talking about Syria, we are talking about Libya, we are talking about Russia. You know, we're talking about, and it all boils back to the question about the art of governing. That's what we basically say at the beginning. That's what Kapuscinski was interested in, to say, well, actually, how do you govern? How do you also control people? How do you, what is the right way of governing? And we know this one is not the right way, but it's one way. And yeah, I always have to stress, basically, it was never about staging a show about a so-called not developed country. It was, you know what I mean? That was always a danger, that we're saying, like, okay, we are not from there and we're going to put this on, but a staged show. But it was always about the parable. It's really interesting, especially in the times that we live in. I mean, you look at Donald Trump and you just can't believe that people buy into this fiction, but they do. And that's what I mean. This is this question about what is politics and what kind of legends do people create in order to govern, and how do they govern, and is it to, what kind of messages do they send out? And of course, the emperor is a very extreme, almost fairy tale, medieval, but at the same time, the questions don't go away about what is fair and how do you deal with, let's say, how do you deal with famine? How do you deal with your international standing? How do you rule, basically?
Mm. Well, we probably should leave it there soon, but just to say, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you could write a book about it. Kapuscinski did. You could make a film about it. Yeah. But the choice to put it on stage and make it very theatrical and physical is an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, actually, to do it with one performer is now in hindsight, and of course, what a performer. But in a way, again, it allows to create within the imagination of the audiences, basically, they see the whole parade. Someone once called it like a musical theater. You look at the backstage of a musical theater in a way and see all these characters bouncing up and down. And I actually think that's not such a bad description, because it was all about performance. It was all about basically serving the emperor. And it was, of course, about theater in a way, a theater of how to behave, how to basically, the jobs you were doing and so forth. So that's why I think going back to this idea of having just Catherine, I think was really, really, and for me as well, because we did this Kafka's Monkey, which was one character. I mean, it was a half human, so half an animal. So obviously that's quite extreme. But this basically was a step further into saying that she's now playing 11 characters. So, and I think she did a really great job, and she's just so, I mean, what you were describing about the transformations, and we just really worked on the physical side. But actually, when we had the first preview where we didn't have lights in between, so we just did hard cuts, like in an interview. And only after the first preview that I decided then to say, no, actually, we want to see her go into the other. So in the first preview, we just had snapshots, really hard cuts. So actually, only from the second preview, we reworked that, and then suddenly we added in light, and suddenly you saw all the transformations, which is very interesting. It's a different show in a way.
Well, it's a pretty well perfect show as far as I'm concerned. So I want to thank you, but I just want to ask you, and I'm so glad that it is going to Manchester, so just a couple more lines on Manchester, because that's really your baby now, isn't it?
That's right. Mm. So home, this building is basically, as I mentioned before, it's got two theatres, five cinemas, and one gallery. And it's basically we've been open now for 15 months only. And we define ourselves a little bit through the cinema side as well, that we see ourselves a bit like art house cinema or independent film. So that's the kind of work we put on, which is quite international and basically sits with that ethos that it's not, we're not doing the commercial big hits in a way. And I think The Empress is very well in this because it, we had Kafka's Monkey there as well. It's experimental, but it's not, it's very accessible, I think. You know, you don't have to read about, you don't have to know anything about Haile Selassie. And I think we are really on a good track, that we basically are building audiences. And I mean, it, obviously, I'm not from the north, so there's lots of sensitivities which I don't know about. But I think after 3 years I've been there now, I feel like I'm really starting to get my feet and to get basically and feel like it's amazing to be part of something completely new, because that building has not existed in the past, so it means there are no ghosts of the past, and we're just slowly building a program which I'm very proud of.
And yet you dare go out of your building and do Romeo and Juliet in a swimming pool of all places. So yeah. You started as you mean to go on, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been intrigued by doing things which are a bit different. So if you, I mean, that's why when you mentioned the Alan Ayckbourn, I love the craft of Alan Ayckbourn, but basically it's not a natural choice for me to do a play. But so Romeo and Juliet in a bath, or I've done a short film with Catherine, a road movie basically in Paris. We've done lots of crazy stuff together, and I always love that adventurous side to it, which is not just commercially driven. I mean, obviously I'm now in the seat where I have to be responsible for budgets as well, so I'm probably growing up a bit more, but it still means, I think, work like The Emperor, for example, is really perfect. I mean, obviously the Young Vic was the main driver behind it, and Colin, who actually brought the project. But I think with our building as well, we are just, in Manchester, we're just trying to establish some new international ways of working together as well, which is great.
And thank you so much for talking
thank you.
To me for Theatre Boys. Walter Meyer Johan, it's been so fascinating and interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you.